chapter 3 this evening for our Bible message. Daniel chapter 3. There is an outline, and I think there's some extras in the back. If you didn't get one of those, just raise your hand and an usher can help. If you do have one, hope yours is in better shape than mine. Levi got a hold of mine this afternoon, so it's a little worse for the wear, but I'm sure we'll get through fine here. Anyone needing an outline? Hopefully that will help you make some sense of, thank you, of what is our theme that we look at together in Daniel chapter 3 this evening. How many of you are competitive by nature? There were like a few that were had to be the first to raise their hand, like it was a contest there for a second, and then Keith gave them an outline, so I shouldn't ask a hand-raising question while we're still passing stuff out, but many of us enjoy a good contest, and maybe that's inborn. I know at our house, things are really turning into competition all the time. Who can run the fastest? Who can jump the highest? Who's the smartest? And then now our kids are wanting to get involved, too, in the competitions. But, you know, life is a contest, in a sense. That's the way Paul puts it, that we're striving for that prize and not wanting to be cast away, not wanting to be disqualified. It's a cosmic contest, a spiritual warfare between good and evil, between light and darkness, between God and Satan and his forces. We have the book, we know the ending, we know who the winning side is, but it's still exciting to watch it unfold. And there are still battles that may be won and may be lost that we play a role in. Scripture's instructive for us and lets us have a window into some of those battles in history so that we can have examples of how to do right, how to succeed. Some quick review. We'll look back at the image one more time that represented from Nebuchadnezzar's dream. The different empires, the world empires, the head represented Babylon. Inferior kingdom would come next, Daniel said in chapter 2. That would be the Medes and Persians, followed by the Greeks. Those empires are specifically named in that order in chapter 8, followed by Rome and then divided kingdoms. And then the dream ended, didn't really get a chance to develop this at the end of last week's message, but there's an image here of a stone made without hands that comes and obliterates the image, and then grows as big as a mountain, and represents Christ's kingdom. He is the stone made without hands. He's referred later to in the book, prophesied as the Son of Man. And in Luke 20, he says it's the one that the builders rejected that becomes the head of the corner. Whoever falls on the stone will be broken, but whoever the stone falls upon will be crushed to powder. He says to Peter in Matthew 16, 18, "On this rock will I build my church," as Peter recognizes Jesus as that Messiah, that Son of Man, the stone made without hands. And so in Ephesians chapter 2, Paul will put it together and say that we are being built on this kingdom that God is making. Jesus is the chief cornerstone, the apostles and prophets are the foundation, and we, as what Peter will call living stones or lively stones, are being built up in that church, which is his body, as he is building his kingdom that someday when he comes to reign will make all earthly kingdoms be forgotten, a reign that never will end. And one of the most impressive, I can't say that, but one of the many impressive prophecies in Scripture. There's no way Daniel could have known the way that these empires would succeed each other, and he gives characteristics about them as you study through the rest of the book, so much so that critics who want to attack the authenticity of Scripture have to say there's no way Daniel could have known, could have written history before it happened in such a way. It must have been written later by someone else pretending to be Daniel. And so then it becomes an argument about dating the book because it's such an accurate prophecy there. But let's look at that image one more time. And remember, it was of the different metals And Daniel interpreted it to Nebuchadnezzar, saying that each metal would represent a different world empire. It's probably with that knowledge ringing in his mind that Nebuchadnezzar is going to take his next action in chapter 3. Now remember, he worships Daniel because of this great interpretation, even acknowledges God as a mighty God, able to give the interpretation of the dream. But it seems that next he's going to take action to try to thwart God's prophecy, to try to manipulate his circumstances so that perhaps the vision will not come true. And so the verse of chapter 3 says, Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So here's the image from the vision, multi-metalled, and watch that morph into a pure gold image that Nebuchadnezzar is going to build. Possibly his attempt to say, no, we're not going to have many kingdoms succeeding of various metals. It's just going to be all gold. It's going to be all me. It's going to be all Babylon and the gods of Babylon. And so he builds this impressive statue. Give you an idea of scale. Here's what a human being next to that statue might look like. Or if we put them vertically, end to end, about 15 persons high, a 90-foot statue. Impressive engineering feat by Nebuchadnezzar and his builders. Not unfathomable, the Sphinx, which dates earlier, is I think 60-some feet high, 240 feet long. And then for scale, compared to the Statue of Liberty, the lady is 111 feet, with the base 300 feet, 305 feet for the Statue of Liberty. Those are both dwarfed by an image in China, the Spring Temple Buddha, who stands 402 feet tall. That's just the image, not counting the base, the Spring Temple Buddha that is worshipped in China. Finished in 2008. 10 years later, in October of 2018, in India was unveiled the new world's largest statue. It's called the Statue of Unity. And that stands at 597 feet. So there you go. You've learned something at the Learn service. But through every age of history, going all the way back to Babel, there's this effort of humans to build a monument to either our own greatness or the greatness of some supposed deity or some ideal like the Statue of Unity, that represents something that humans can look to and exalt other than God. And this is a pattern that Nebuchadnezzar continues even here in Daniel chapter 3. In the book of Daniel, there's kind of two, these first six chapters, we see kind of two competing storylines from my perspective. You see, it's kind of obvious, I hope, Daniel and his friends. So you have these people in the minority who are trying to live righteously in a pagan society. And that's what we often notice as the theme of the book. But then there's this other competing theme of these pagan kings who are far from God, who have exalted themselves in their own minds above God, who worship other gods, who God is bringing to a position of recognition of his greatness. Whether they're ready for it or not, these pagan kings, a few of them in the book of Daniel, are going to learn of his greatness. So you've got Daniel, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, who believe in God's greatness and are trying to stand for it against all odds, and then these pagan kings who seem to have all the power and control who are needing to learn these lessons about God's greatness. And so Nebuchadnezzar, we see, is going to try to manipulate his circumstances rather than submitting to God. And that's what some of us do. When we know God's instruction, when we see God's warnings, but we try to cover our bases. We try to get everything set just right. So, well, yeah, I've got my accounts to where even if God doesn't bless me financially, I should be okay. Or whatever else it is. We try to go around and fix things. And I know this relationship is probably off limits, but if I do this and change these things around and try to make sure that everything is checked boxes, that I can still get by okay. And we try to manipulate our circumstances instead of submitting to God. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah instead are going to submit to God regardless of their circumstances, even when it looks like the hardest thing to do. So on your outline, you have two competing mantras. The first thing to write there for Nebuchadnezzar's mantra is basically we're going to see this play out in his actions. Disregard God at any cost. That seems to be Nebuchadnezzar's mantra. Disregard God at any cost. Oh, he's acknowledged him in chapter 2 that he must be great, but he's not ready to submit to him. He wants to keep him at arm's length and disregard this vision of prophecy that he's given him through Daniel. And so he's trying to find another way. He's trying to keep his kingdom going. He's trying to maintain his own greatness. He doesn't want to submit to God. He's going to disregard God at any cost. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, their mantra seems to be submit to God at any cost. Submit to God at any cost. And so, in a contest, we see these two mantras collide throughout the book of Daniel. None more climactic than here in chapter 3, where these two mantras really come at odds. They come head to head, and only one side can win. We'll see as you fill out the outline that the odds are really stacked in Nebuchadnezzar's favor from an earthly perspective, but we'll see how it turns out. Daniel was probably back at the palace during this scene. You notice in verse 1 that the image is built out in the plains of Dura. We don't know exactly where that is, but likely several miles away from where the palace is. The last verse of chapter 2 tells us that Daniel has gained a position in the king's gate. So probably Daniel is back in the palace, or at least in the king's court, while everyone else is going to be drawn to Dura for the dedication of this image. That image you saw a moment ago, the Statue of Unity in India, you can look up a video of its dedication where the prime minister is sprinkling flower petals and blessings on this Statue of Unity. A dedication for this image here in chapter 3, and it could be that here's, and we will read these verses soon, that Nebuchadnezzar's motivation goes like this. Well, if another kingdom, this silver kingdom, whoever that is coming after me, I've got to prevent that. There's this God of heaven that thinks that's going to happen. I'm going to appeal to my gods and try to make sure that doesn't happen. I want my kingdom to endure forever. So what can I do to make sure no kingdom takes over my kingdom? Well, he's looking outside and doesn't see any armies as powerful as his. He doesn't think the threat's coming from outside, maybe. And so who could it be in his own empire that's disloyal? Well, here's a way to find out. I'll construct this image to my own glory, to the glory of my Babylonian gods. I'll require everyone who's anyone to come to the dedication of it and bow down and worship. Then I can be assured of the loyalty of all the higher-ups in my whole kingdom. And so there can't be any risk of any uprising. No conspiracies. I'm going to test everyone's loyalty with an image that's full gold, probably not solid gold, probably covered in gold. Other times in the Bible, it talks about things that were gold and then gives detail that it was overlaid with gold, but still quite a bit of gold, of course, and none of the other metals from the image in the vision. And so he's going to test everyone's loyalty. Maybe that's his thinking. So we pick it up in verse 2. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, sent to gather together the princes, the governors, and the captains, and the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. You see some repetition here to emphasize it's all about Nebuchadnezzar and everyone's going to be there. Some more repetition will come throughout the chapter you're familiar with. verse 4, then a herald cried aloud, to you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. And whosoever falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. We see first, under Nebuchadnezzar's mantra of disregarding God, that he has the majority and he has the fanfare. You've got all kinds of music here, big scene. All the nations, all the leaders from everywhere, all of them will fall down and worship this image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. An overwhelming majority and an impressive fanfare. By contrast, you can write on the other side that Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael are in the extreme minority. And instead of fanfare, they are going to look like misfits. They're not going to fit in with what the majority is doing. It's not always bad to be a misfit. I think it was C.S. Lewis that said, when everyone is headed toward a cliff, the person running the opposite direction looks like a lunatic. Okay, often we feel like misfits, but it's not always a bad thing. Verse 8, wherefore at that time certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. Okay, here's the highlights, kind of the fact that they are misfits. They're singled out by their nationality. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar has conquered Judah, carried many of the Israelites there captive. Nebuchadnezzar has done this to many other nations. His empire is a conglomeration of peoples that he has conquered. And so you see all nations mentioned, gathered here to worship this image. And these Chaldeans, maybe they're jealous from the scene in chapter 2 and the promotion that Daniel and his friends received. There's such a big crowd, and these Hebrew children apparently didn't intentionally make a scene out of this, but some tattletales had to go, oh, I saw a few people who didn't bow down, these Jews. And so verse 9, they, the Chaldeans, spake and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. The third time now these instruments are listed here. It's an impressive fanfare. This group apparently was selected specifically for this dedication day. J. Vernon McGee suggests a name for them, for this band. He calls them the Babylonian Beboppers that are here for the dedication of this image. They get their instruments mentioned three different times. There will be a fourth to come yet. I don't know where he got that, but that's nice. The Babylonian Beboppers, yeah. And then, so we see, hey, this is the king, right? They're talking to him. They say, king, live forever. Here's your rule. And one more point to put under Nebuchadnezzar, kind of on his side, is that he's the captor. He's the king, right? He's got these people that he has conquered. They're under his domain now. He's the king that should live forever. He's the one who makes the rules. And verse 11 says, the Chaldeans are repeating Nebuchadnezzar's own rule to him. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth, that he should be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. See, music is really closely connected with worship. Music is used to express worship for good or for evil. Here, obviously, in an evil way. when the Israelites constructed a golden calf, all kinds of music that Moses and Joshua hear. It sounds like a ruckus when they come down from the mountain. In fact, when they hear the music, they think there's a war in the camp. Music closely connected to worship, for good or for bad. We also have instructions in many places in the Bible to use music for good in worship. In verse 12, there are certain Jews, again, pointing out their nationality. There's some anti-Semitism present here in Babylon, just as there would be on Haman's part a couple of generations later. And really throughout history, since Abraham, God's people with a target on them because of Satan trying to thwart what God wants to do through his chosen nation. Fortunately, in those times that they're following him, they have not only a target by the world, but a shield from God. But God's people, even we who are not physical Israelites, I don't think anyone is here tonight, we'll have a target as God's people, but a shield when we're faithfully following him. There are certain Jews, verse 12, whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We get their Babylonian names from the time of their promotion at the end of chapter 2 and onward, which is fine. Then, O king, they have not regarded thee, the end of verse 12. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Okay, they are supposed to obey the rules, so we see over on their side that, well, he's the captor and he's the king, they are, by default then, the captives, and they are the subjects. So in this struggle between God and those who will follow him, and Nebuchadnezzar and his gods and those who will follow him, we're seeing that really it's been more and more stacked in Nebuchadnezzar's favor, in a sense. Verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now, if ye be ready, that at what time ye hear the Babylonian beboppers, ye fall down and worship the image which I have made, well. But if ye worship not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? Nebuchadnezzar says, look, the deck is stacked in my favor. I'm the king, you're the subjects, I'm the captor, you're the captives, I'm the majority, you're the minority. I have the authority to take life, Nebuchadnezzar assumed. That's the next point under his side. Chalk one up for him, the authority to take life, while by contrast, all the Hebrew children had was the ability to surrender life. Doesn't seem like a very powerful position to come from, but it is something. That's what they have, the ability to surrender their life. We'll find out later that Nebuchadnezzar has on his side armed soldiers. He's got a whole army of them. They're victorious soldiers. Whereas Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael are unarmed civilians. They're not going to be able to, you know, stage a rebellion. They're not going to have a fighting chance. All they have is the ability to give their lives. There was a common expectation in that day that when one army was victorious over another, that was symbolic that that nation's gods were more powerful than the defeated nation's gods. And so when Babylon defeats Judah and carries them away, they don't know anything about that being part of God's plan. They don't know that the true God had prophesied that generations in advance and warned of it repeatedly. All they see is they won the war, Therefore, Bel and Nebo and Aku must be more powerful than Yahweh. That was their supposition. There's some descriptions of what that fiery furnace might have been like. Have you ever been curious about that? A kiln would have been close by. So Nebuchadnezzar builds this huge statue out in the plains of Dura. Well, what are they going to need if it's going to have a big base, which is quite likely? And the image itself, possibly made of bricks. They're going to need a big kiln to make bricks and to smelt the gold to cover the image with. So very likely, here's a picture of, you know, an artist's rendering of what that furnace may have looked like. The opening surely would not have been so large, but it gives you an idea there. Gleason Archer states that Mesopotamian smelting furnaces tended to be like an old-fashioned glass milk bottle in shape, you have the idea there, with a large opening for the insertion of the ore to be smelted, and a smaller aperture, a smaller opening at the ground level for the admission of wood and charcoal to furnish the heat. So kind of a milk bottle shape. Probably wouldn't have been wide open on the front, but one opening on the top to put your materials in, an opening at the bottom to put your fuel in. Baldwin, another scholar, reports that the temperatures in these kilns could reach as high as 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit. So you get the idea of a burning fiery furnace. Not for sure that it was a kiln, but a likely scenario here on the plains of Dura. Here's an actual picture of an ancient kiln. Probably the top of it has eroded away and probably some modern repairs done as well. But if it was on the side of a mound like this, you could see how soldiers could come kind of up the hill and drop the Hebrew children into the furnace from the top. You can see an opening in the front where the soldiers could heat the furnace hotter by giving more fuel in, and also an opening where Nebuchadnezzar is able to look in from a safe distance and get a glimpse of what's going on inside. So in verses 16 and 18, we'll see the next points on Nebuchadnezzar's side. Well, he's got a fiery furnace. Okay, if it is indeed there close by the statue, as is likely the case, it's already burning as a visual representation of what's going to happen to anyone who doesn't follow the king. Because remember, he's trying to have his bases covered. This whole thing, quite possibly, is a test to make sure everyone's loyal to him, to his gods, and to the Babylonian Empire. So the idea is to get all the leaders there. If anyone doesn't bow down, we know they're probably the problem. And so we'll have... Well, Nebuchadnezzar says, well, I'll take care of that. I'll execute them on the spot. Therefore, any uprising is thwarted before it even has a chance to begin. Seems like he's got his bases covered really well as he sees the odds continue to stack in his favor. But what Azariah, Mishael, and Hananiah had was they had a firm faith. And they saw the furnace. They saw the image. They saw everyone else, literally everyone else, multitudes, likely even some of their own countrymen that had come with them from Israel, bowing down and worshiping these false gods. They have a firm faith. And so in verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. Now here's a shift from the trend we've seen in the way God's people are portrayed in relation to authority in these exilic books. We've noted how Mordecai and Esther and Daniel, Ezra and Nehemiah have all have very respectful attitudes, even toward their pagan kings. They followed the biblical instruction that even when you're in a heathen environment, live and pray for peace in that environment, to be good citizens, to submit to those who have the rule over us. And they follow that pattern consistently. You see a shift in their tone, certainly here in this case, foreshadowing Mordecai when he refuses to bow to Haman later in the book of Esther. And we see once again where the line is that we won't cross, that we'll submit to authority. that we'll do it in an honorable and respectful manner whenever we possibly can, knowing that the powers that be are ordained of God. But when there comes the command that would violate the purity of our worship of the one true God, then we have to take a stand. We have to oppose authority. We have to say with the apostles in the book of Acts, we ought to serve God rather than man. And so Mordecai won't bow to Haman in worship. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they won't bow to this image in worship because to do so would violate the loyalty so intrinsic to being a follower of the true God. So they're not careful to answer. There's a different tone. And in verse 17, if it be so, okay, if we are truly to be cast into this fiery furnace, our God whom we serve, this contest is coming to a head. Nebuchadnezzar so boldly says, who's the God that can protect you from me? I've got the furnace right here. You have nothing. But if it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. Might not be reading too much into it to suggest that they are confident that God will deliver them from Nebuchadnezzar, but unsure as to whether they'll be delivered from the fiery furnace. Does that make sense? They recognize, okay, we might die in that burning fiery furnace, we might not, but either way, O king, God will deliver us from your hand. He's going to deliver them either by protecting them in the furnace or by just taking them home through the furnace. They know that deliverance is guaranteed. We just don't know the manner or the timing of that deliverance. That's the firm faith that we share with these believers from long ago. As we face our trials, we know, well, we might be delivered from the trial, or we might be delivered through the trial, but God will be with us. And if we are faithful to Him, if we maintain that firm faith, He will see us through. They may or may not be delivered physically, so they say in verse 18, but if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Nebuchadnezzar is ready to give a second chance. He's going to strike up the band again and say, hey, people, we're going to do this one more time just for these three who didn't get it the first time. And they say, that's not necessary. Maybe they didn't want to hear the song again. I don't know, but they say, save your time, king. We're not going to worship your gods. They remembered Scripture, Exodus chapter 20. God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which hath brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. This first and second commandment from the Decalogue, so important, so foundational to Yahweh worship. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, we won't compromise here. You know, a lot of people might have said, you know, it's not a big deal. It's just a statue. Just go along with everyone. Don't make a scene. You can't live for God if you die in the furnace. But no, it was a big deal. And it is a big deal when our faith is tested, when our loyalty is tested by the trials we face, whether we will do right or whether we will compromise with those around us. God had delivered his people from a furnace before. Egypt is referenced there in Exodus 20 and a few other times. And remember that the Israelites were charged with making bricks. They were brick makers for 400 plus years in Egypt, working in the kilns. And so the Bible refers to that period of Israelite slavery as time in the iron furnace. So for example, Deuteronomy 4:20, the Lord hath taken you and brought you forth out of the iron furnace, even out of Egypt, to be unto him a people, an inheritance that ye are this day. 1 Kings 8:50 and 51, a prayer, forgive thy people that have sinned against thee, and have compassion on them, for they be thy people and thine inheritance, which thou broughtest forth out of Egypt from the midst of the furnace of iron. In Jeremiah 11:4, which I have commanded your fathers in the day that I brought them forth out of the land of Egypt from the iron furnace, saying, obey my voice and do them according to all which I commanded you. So shall you be my people, and I will be your God. Maybe Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are meditating on these passages, and they know God has delivered our people from a furnace before, and he can do it again. We're not going to compromise in this important commandment. We, looking back, can see now a couple of times to build on and say God has delivered his people from fiery furnaces multiple times in the past. In Hebrews 11, have quenched the fires of God's enemies, those who live in faith. And we can as well, as we're faithful to him and face those trials. We'll see finally in verse 19 through 26, Nebuchadnezzar, he's got all the gods of Babylon, supposedly, with a small g there. Whereas the Israelites had only the one God of heaven. Verses 19 through 26. Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed. That means his face, his facial expression changed. He lost control. He was furious. This is the third time in three chapters, or at least in chapter 2, that we learn of Nebuchadnezzar growing very angry. We have a picture of a king who's not under control, despite the illusion of control. Meanwhile, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego seem very calm and resolute, though they would apparently have no control because they trust in God's control. His visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, verse 19. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace one seven times more than it was wont to be heated. Okay, he doesn't have a dial to turn, but as a expression to do something to the max, to do it completely, we say seven times. And so heated as hot as possible, they threw as many sticks or coal or fuel, whatever fuel they had, to heat it as hot as possible. And verse 20, he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. All right, here's where the climax is coming. Doesn't look good. It's not just a furnace, it's a fiery furnace. So that's just a fiery furnace, it's a burning fiery furnace. And it's not just a burning fiery furnace, but they're cast into this fiery furnace. They're not just cast in, they're cast in bound. And they're not just cast in bound, they're cast in by men, not just men, but the mightiest men in Nebuchadnezzar's army. This is the best he can muster, and it's pretty impressive. Therefore, verse 22, because the king's commandment was urgent and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Perhaps just because they got so close to the opening, or maybe the wind shifts, but these men, the strongest in his army, fall down dead. Verse 23, and these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Would seem like the end. Nebuchadnezzar is watching, maybe out of some sadistic desire to see them pay for their insolence. Or maybe he's just so paranoid about his throne, he has to see the opposers die. And so the king was astonished, verse 24, he's astonished and rose up in haste and spake and said unto his counselors, did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said unto the king, true, O king. And he answered and said, lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurts, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spake and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth and come hither. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth out of the midst of the fire. What a beautiful victory. I like how in verse 25 they're walking in the midst of the fire. So they fall down in their bound. They're able to get up. And why would you walk around in there? Maybe it's just really cool. Like, hey, guys, check this out. And they're walking around. They're just walking around. The fire is not affecting them. Can you imagine? But of course, the most wondrous part of being in there is that fourth image that's there with them. We're not told specifically who it is. All we have is Nebuchadnezzar's words. He says, like, the Son of God, or possibly translated, a son of the gods. He didn't know anything about the true God or the Trinity of God having a son. Later, he's going to refer to him as an angel. That's all we have in Scripture, but probably an appearance of Jesus Christ, who appears other times in the Old Testament, called the angel of the Lord, clearly the second person of the Trinity, Jesus there with his people through their time of trial. Nebuchadnezzar can't believe his eyes. Not only can Nebuchadnezzar not believe his eyes, verse 27, the princes, governors, and captains, and the king's counselors being gathered together saw these men. All these people that Nebuchadnezzar had gathered from every corner of his empire to be able to see the greatness of Nebuchadnezzar and his gods, instead are witnesses to the greatness of the one true God. They saw these men upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was an hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. They didn't even smell like smoke. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies." Remember, the king's word can't be changed in the Babylonian culture. It's his command, and no one is to say no. His word is changed and yielded their bodies that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill. What is it with Nebuchadnezzar? That's like his go-to threat. If anyone crosses him, cut him up and make their house a dunghill, because there's no other God that can deliver after this sort. And the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Now, Nebuchadnezzar isn't quite there yet. In chapter 2, he recognized, wow, this God is powerful. He can interpret dreams and even reveal dreams. In chapter 3, he recognizes, wow, this is the Most High God. He's still going to acknowledge other gods. He's still going to view himself very highly as favored by his own gods. But now he's taken another step. First, he recognizes that God is powerful in chapter 2. In chapter 3, he recognizes that he is the most powerful God. He still has a ways to go, and we'll see it in the next chapter. But for now, he at least has made a rule that no one can say anything bad about the Israelites' God. Let's go back through this list that looks very one-sided, and now you have space between your points to pencil in how these things turned out. Okay, we know who looked the strongest and who looked the weakest, but how did it really turn out? Well, the ones with the majority and the fanfare lost. Don't you love it when that happens? You like to cheer for the underdog? The minority, the misfits, won. The captor, the king, bowed down by the end of the story. The captives, the subjects, would not bow. The one with authority to take life failed to do so. The ones with the ability to surrender their life, that's all they could do, but yet they lived. They survived. The armed soldiers, who would be heavily favored in that contest, died. The unarmed civilians survived. They lived. The fiery furnace was powerless. The firm faith, powerful. All the gods of Babylon apparently were absent, like on Mount Carmel and another great contest between the true God and false, while the one God of heaven was imminently present there with his people in the midst of their trial. In summary, Nebuchadnezzar ruled, gods of Babylon ruled, but God overrules. He's present with his people. Aren't you thankful for the promise of Isaiah 43, verses 1 and 2? But now thus saith the Lord that created thee, O Jacob, and he that formed thee, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed thee. I have called thee by thy name. Thou art mine. When thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee. God doesn't promise to keep us from trials, but he promises to keep us through trials when we're faithful to him. And through the rivers, they shall not overflow thee. When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee. The only thing the fire destroyed was Nebuchadnezzar's men and Nebuchadnezzar's ropes. The Israelites were completely unharmed because God was with them. Now again, others have faced those times of trial, and like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego admitted, okay, God might not deliver us from that, physically speaking, and others have died through fire, like in Paul's day, like William Tyndale, much later, John Huss, men who were burned for their stand for God. But God delivered them in a different manner. Well, we trust they're with him now, based on their faith in him. So it's not that God will deliver us from every trial, but he will be with us. He is the present God through every trial. So three messages here. One for those who are not submitting to God. They're in Nebuchadnezzar's place, trying to do everything they can to disregard God's rule, his call on their life. Know that historically, okay, history isn't kind to those who oppose themselves to God. You can never win that. The only hope, even though it looks like the odds are stacked against him, is to join God's side, is to submit to him. To those who are faithful believers, trying to do right, even when we're in the minority, even when we're misfits, even when those fiery trials loom in our presence and it's hard to do right and maybe you're tempted to waver as those around you are doing, stay faithful. Do the right thing. Stand for your moral principles. Stand for God. And trust him to take care of you. Then maybe for a believer who's not living faithfully. So like in your faith, you're with Nebuchadnezzar, with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You believe in the true God. You're a follower of him. But your lifestyle, your value system, your mantra looks more like Nebuchadnezzar's. And you're really trying to be a Christian and yet disregard God as much as possible. And say, yeah, I'll be a Christian. I want to go to heaven, yes. But I don't want God to have complete control of my relationships or my finances or my career or my personal life. I want to do as much as I can without submitting to God and just protect and manipulate my circumstances but still have a relationship with him. Know that though it appears we have something to lose by going all in for God, we in reality have only to gain by surrendering everything to his will. By giving up 100% control, by saying, I'm going to submit to God no matter what the cost. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were willing to do. These three, Daniel in chapter 2 and again in chapter 6, were willing to sacrifice everything to stand for God. But as it turns out, they didn't sacrifice anything. They stood only to gain because of their firm faith, because of their faithfulness to the one who overrules. Let's pray and ask his blessing as we seek to do the same.